Welcome to How I Raised It, the podcast that goes behind the scenes with entrepreneurs who've raised capital. We uncover the tips, tricks, and techniques they use to get investors to write a check. Strap in and turn it up.
Hi, welcome to another episode of How I Raised It, produced by Foundersuite.com. Today I have Derek Anderson of Bevy and Startup Grind coming to us from his sister's house in Salt Lake City. How's it going, Derek?
Great. Doing great.
Yeah. Are you originally from Salt Lake City?
I grew up in Tampa, Florida, and we moved around Europe. I lived over there for about 6 years, and then I did high school just north of Salt Lake City, and then college here, and then I moved to Palo Alto, where I currently live, about 15 years ago.
Right. Yeah. I think I've met you at least 5+ years, maybe even longer. I'm sure probably one of your events, and, you know, appreciate all the support you've given Founder Suite over the years. So awesome. Well, let's get into a little bit. What is Bevy? Let's start with Bevy. We're going to bounce back and forth a little bit between your two businesses, but let's start with Bevy, which just raised a new round. Tell us about Bevy.
Yeah, Bevy is the only enterprise-grade virtual community platform, and what we help people do is to scale their virtual event programs across the world sort of overnight, and you can do that virtually, you can do that in person, you can do that with your team, you can do that with your customers, and we sort of help people manage all of those programs from one central place, white labeled on your website, so it feels and looks like, you know, the brand's experience that is hosting the events. And and we work with companies like Salesforce and Duolingo, Atlassian, Twitter, many others.
And so is this, obviously this is amazing timing, but I'm sure you weren't planning for a pandemic. Like, what was the genesis behind this idea?
Well, in 2015, co-founded this community, Startup Grind, which you mentioned, and we have chapters all across the world. At the time, we had about 150 chapters in, you know, maybe, I don't know, 60 different countries. And we had these tools that we kind of duct taped together to run these chapters. And we're using things like Eventbrite and MailChimp and Meetup and WordPress and other things. And we sort of just duct taped it all together, honestly. And it worked for the first few dozen, but then at you know, plus 100 groups, the scale of it started to just buckle the whole system. And we started to have these really passionate community leaders just get really angry with us and sort of demand a solution. And so we spent most of 2015 sort of building a solution. And then in 2016, we onboarded ourselves and our growth took off. And following that, we started signing up other customers to use the platform, and we white labeled it for them. And so from there in 2017, we actually spun it out of Startup Grind into a new company, raised angel funding on it then, and have been going ever since like that.
That's so fascinating. Give us an example, like a Duolingo or a company, you know, similar to that. Like, what do they come on and what do they do? Kind of the use cases.
Yeah. So Duolingo, for instance, they have an incredible online community, people learning languages through the mobile app primarily, hundreds of millions of people. They came to us about 3 years ago and said, hey, how can we get our audiences learning in new and different ways? And what better way to learn a language than in person? And so we started sort of helping them really from the very beginning to run the sort of in-person event program, and they've scaled it unlike any organization I've ever seen, where they were doing, first they were doing 100 events a month, then they were doing 100 events a week, then they're doing 500 events a week, and these are all in-person events run by the community themselves. And so our software, it's something we call customer-to-customer marketing. You know, the most powerful form of marketing is word of mouth and getting your customers to talk about you. And so Bevy is sort of a way to engineer word of mouth marketing amongst your customers and potential customers. And so we sort of facilitated them getting the community involved to run those programs for them. And now they've shifted to virtual, where they're doing basically the same quantity and the same scale virtually. Same with like an Atlassian, where you get you know, user groups for Jira or Trello or Confluent, and they empower their customers to be part of that, or Salesforce Trailblazers. Some people probably heard of that community, and we help power that. And then we also help schools. So, you know, somebody like Lambda School, getting their alumni together, or getting their cohort together, or my alma mater, which is Brigham Young University. So we run their entire alumni program. And, you know, that's really run by the alumni themselves, these sort of local chapters in cities around the United States and around the world.
And what's the most common actual functionality use case? Is it webinars? Is it a chat room? Is it, you know, community means a lot of different things, but what are people
doing? That's right. Yeah, I mean, primarily it's hosting events, and then it's all the activity and the interactions around those events, from the data retrieval pre-event to all the email communications and subscriptions that users sign up for, topics, other things that they're interested in, to the event itself, checking people in, you know, seeing when they come and go, questions that they're asking, and then, you know, post-event, you know, doing the survey, administering that, tying and threading all of those results in together from the entire process. And you get this really, really incredible and rich data set from customers or potential customers that you can, you know, use to help them more in other ways with your product.
Interesting. I'm going to make you put on your salesperson hat for a minute, because we've, here at Founder Street, we've been thinking, like, during, you know, assuming we might stay locked down for a while, we've been thinking about doing like VC Ask Me Anythings, or maybe live like Shark Tank pitch events. So pitch me as a customer. What could I do on Bevy?
Well, I love sales, so I thank you for the opportunity. probably many founders listening, like I was, you know, I did the first million plus in sales in the company, basically all just myself. I was the sales team.
Good for you.
The team's much better at it now than I am. But I think, look, like if you, you know, especially during the pandemic, like we as suppliers and as product makers, like it's critical for us to try to build and support, build community and support our audience wherever they are. And right now they're stuck at home under quarantine, or at least in most places around the world. So, you know, I think you put on your hat and say, like, for the good of my community, what can I do to help them right now, to educate them, to help them be less lonely, to bring them more of a feeling of belonging? From a business perspective, how can I get more deeply engaged with my customer? How can I improve retention? How can I improve customer acquisition and you know, acquire new customers the cheapest rate possible?
Yeah.
And so I think what we have found with the customers that we work with is whichever your sort of metrics are, whether it's your sort of, you know, your general like health of my customer base or my like community goals in general, or whether it's purely, you know, business related goals, events, virtual events specifically right now are an incredibly cheap. We have data that shows it's the very cheapest form of user acquisition. Jason Lemkin from Saster said recently the 40% of SaaS companies fill their pipelines from events. So if you're not hosting events, you're probably completely missing out on an opportunity to find new customers. And so, you know, why Bevy? You'd say, like, well, Bevy allows you to do it at huge scale with the least amount of work possible. And so you would have the highest ROI of any virtual event program that you'd be running right now doing it with Bevy than with some other tool.
Interesting. Well, maybe we can follow up offline and I'll explore a little deeper. We're trying to figure out best ways to kind of facilitate connections between our customers. We've got about 2,000 startups, and then of course investors, because they're all using our software to try and raise money. So we're trying to, you know, facilitate that community, and it's cool. Well, very good. let's rewind the clock a little bit. If I mean, I'm assuming 99.9% of listeners are familiar with what Startup Grind is, but maybe give the high level, you know, one liner about what that is, your previous business.
Startup Grind's goal is to educate and support every startup in the world. We started in my office in Mountain View, California. And
what year was that?
About 10 years ago, February of 2010, we had our 10-year anniversary just right as sort of COVID took off. We've hosted about 15,000 events in that time in more than 120 countries. In the last 3 years, we've hosted about 300,000 people in person. And that has dramatically shifted in the last few months where we have, you know, in April of 2019, we hosted about 4,000 people in person. In April of 2020, we hosted 40,000 people virtually. So it's primarily driven by the community. We have these really passionate, incredible, what we call chapter directors who are sort of the startup mayor in their city. And they run the local chapter and they bring the startup community together and great entrepreneurs and thought leaders and you know, authors and journalists and others to the stage to be interviewed and to speak and to give access to themselves to the startup community. And we do maybe 250 events a month, something like that. It was started as a complete accident. It was not what I was doing. I was working on something else, but nobody liked the product I was working on, but they really liked this sort of dumb event series that we were hosting in my office. And so, you know, as any, entrepreneur hopefully will do is you see something working, you should do more of that. So we sold the product we were working on at the time and focused totally on Startup Grind and things kind of had an unnatural organic momentum that we hadn't seen with other things we had been working on.
Yeah. I was going to ask what you were doing before and where the idea for Startup Grind came from. Cause I remember when you kind of burst on the scene and you really was a burst. Like it wasn't just like, oh, there's a little event series that's sort of spreading. I mean, you came in, you know, like a hurricane, or at least that's my impression.
So appreciate that.
What were you doing before? It was some other software business or what?
Yeah, I worked at Electronic Arts as a product manager, left my job in 2009 and just started building products. I built, you know, probably 8 or 9 different things that no one's ever heard of or used or liked. And, you know, I built an iPad app, raised, you know, angel funding on that, and that completely flopped. I built a social network, for professionals. I built a consulting business. Ultimately the thing that we sold was a sort of professional social network but you know, most of the things that we built were pretty bad, honestly. But it was sort of, you know, that's sort of my education process. And what I realized was that, you know, when I worked at EA, they'd spend all this money bringing in all these fancy speakers and people to educate you and train you. And when you're in a startup, like nobody cares what you're working on except for, you know, your parents and one, you know, one of your sisters. And so, you have to find ways to educate yourself. And that's what we started to do in my office. And it turned out, much to my shock and surprise, that other people all over the world had the same problem. And so we, you know, thankfully, you know, we're able to sort of ride that wave of you know, sort of this boom coming out of the recession. And you think about, I mean, you think about the people listening right now, and I'm sure many people, startups that were already struggling are struggling exponentially now, more now. I think if you can try to find a way to like keep some optimism coming out of this whole crisis, I mean, I know it's so hard and so like almost twisted to think about, but I just remember coming out of 2009. I mean, I had survived 3 or 4 rounds of layoffs at EA and I eventually just quit. I just was dissatisfied working there. But I, you know, it was a time where there was so much sadness and pessimism and I was incredibly optimistic and had a lot of energy, and that energy I think sort of was able to get me from A to wherever I needed to get to when other people were probably had just been through the war. Yeah. And, you know, and I think, you know, right now I'm sort of living with you and others, you know, we're running businesses through this, we're sort of living through the war, but there will be people that will come after, or they can kind of survive this, you know, and maybe almost being smaller right now is a benefit. You know, if you're at 10, you know, if you have 50 people in your company right now, and you don't have a self-sustaining business model, you could literally be in huge trouble. Or if you're at 550 employees and you couldn't get access to the PPP, and you're in one of these sectors that got decimated, like, you are screwed. And so, like, if you're five people, or if you're two people, this may be a huge advantage to you. And coming out of this, whenever that is. I know that's sort of how I felt coming out of the last recession. And, you know, there's probably other people listening to this that hopefully can see some optimism for themselves coming out of whenever this crisis starts to resolve itself.
I like it. I like it. I'm a huge sailor. And one of the things that the metaphors I keep thinking about is, like, sometimes you're trying to win a race, or, you know, you're in a race and the wind's against you, the current's against you, and it's like taking all your effort just to stay in place and not slip backwards. But then, you know, when things shift, you're ahead of the game, right? Eventually things come back and the wind turns back around and in your favor, and you're, you know, even just staying in place was the right thing to do and an advantage. It positions you to win the race, right? I mean, it's just a metaphor I think about a lot, so.
Yeah, I like that. I love that. And I think right now, yeah, like, if you survive, you've won.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I've had conversation with lots of different people in different industries. I don't have any expectation to make any money this year. I mean, it's just like that's the furthest thing from my mind. I just want to, like, if I can just be flat, like, if I can be just $1 in the green, like, I've won this year, yeah. You know? And so I think this is frustrating to me with a lot of these layoffs and things that people are doing. I understand why they do it, but a lot of people are doing it opportunistically just to improve the balance sheet. They're not doing it because they have to. They're doing it just because that's what you do. You're always optimizing in your business. And I think it's really, you know, I haven't had to do layoffs yet, but I might at some point. So, you know, I really empathize with people that have been in that situation. A lot of people are doing it because they have no other choice. But I think, you know, it's our responsibility as business owners and CEOs and founders is to do everything we can to try to help people, and not at the sake of sinking the ship, but at least, like, if we can break even this year, like, you should consider that a huge win and not have to lay anyone off. Like, wow, what an accomplishment that would be. And then we can grow in other years in the future. And that's sort of how I've been thinking about it.
Good stuff. All right, let's talk about fundraising, because this is the topic of the show. Did you raise any money for Startup Grind, or was that totally bootstrapped?
Bootstrap, 7 years.
That's amazing. You probably, any interest in sharing a revenue figure for Startup Grind, or is that confidential?
I mean, you know, we're in the low millions of dollars in revenue. We've made payroll for the last 7 years. We've had opportunities to raise. I'm not sure if Startup Grind's, you know, ever going to be a multi-billion-dollar business or not. It doesn't really need to be. You know, I'd like it to be a big business, but I think that's sort of where the hesitation's always come for me to raise funding. Of, you know, you shouldn't raise funding unless you're planning to. You have a clear path to building something big, or you're going to be really misaligning expectations, and so that never really made a lot of sense to me. So we've just, you know, kind of run it as a, I hate the word small business. I hate that phrase. We've run it like, you know, just bootstrapped and profitable, and
yeah,
you know, try to maintain cash flow, and definitely some scary times. But we survived to this point, thankfully.
You know, jumping around a little bit, but one of the things I think was so brilliant is sort of what I call, or think of it as your franchise model, where you have these community managers, right? I mean, you didn't just start as an event series and then try and grow city by city. Like, you know, like a virus, horrible metaphor, but like a virus, I mean, you've spread wildly.
Virus of love.
Yeah. Startup virus of love. I thought that was interesting, but yeah, was that premeditated, like, to have this sort of almost, you know?
No, I mean, I honestly, like, I had never thought. When the first time somebody approached me with the idea, somebody that attended was like, "Hey, we should do this in my city. This is so cool." I honestly, I thought it was a terrible idea. It never crossed my mind. It was never the intention. There were other ideas we thought were much better than that. But this person was really persistent and said, well, we don't have anything to lose. Might as well try it. And the first one was in LA. I flew down there for it. I did the interview. And people came up after, and the feedback was so overwhelmingly positive. Hey, we don't have this. It's like, this is LA. How can you not have something like Startup Grind? It's like, it's pretty simple. Yeah. And, but apparently they didn't. And then once we got out of the big cities, it really didn't exist. And so this kind of connective, you have these chapters around the world that are sort of connected together, and people, sort of built around common values and a common cause, it resonated with people. But no, I had no idea that was going to be the thing.
I went and did I was actually the guest or the speaker at a Startup Grind in Tampa, 2 years ago or something like that. And it was super fun. Great little community, just really fun. So, I mean, you guys are doing a good job of like making the speakers, you know, enjoy it, which I think is also pretty key.
Were you on vacation down there, or were you actually like, did you go down for that, or?
I was on vacation. My wife's from Tampa, but it worked out, and it was fun. It's good. So
that's great. Yeah, I think, I mean, that was, you know, just trying to make an experience, like a good experience for the speaker, a good experience for the chapter director to do all the work. And then we sort of focused on those two things. And then if we knew if we did that, then the audience would have a good experience. I mean, you can kind of just, you know, we've had some entrepreneurs, you know, like the founder of Zendesk, for instance, Mikkel, saying he, you know, wherever he goes, he speaks at Startup Grind. He's spoken in three different continents or something like that. And he can just sort of show up in Melbourne, Australia, and get 100 people to, you know, come listen to him speak. And then he can go sleep in his hotel. It's really easy. And that gets us sort of repeat speakers and really high quality people coming back over and over again.
Awesome. Bevy, how much have you guys raised? And you mentioned an angel round, and then most recently, I think there was a pretty big round. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so we raised about $2 million originally in 2017 as sort of an angel round. I mean, you could call it pre-seed. It's sort of all semantics from my perspective. But so we called it our seed round. And then we raised a Series A with Upfront Ventures the next year in 2018, summer of 2018, with Kobe Fuller at Upfront Ventures. It's the largest venture capital firm in Los Angeles. And then we just recently raised about $15 million with Excel Partners out of Palo Alto. Ryan Sweeney is the partner there. And then Ryan Smith, who's the CEO and founder of Qualtrics, has previously invested, but he invested again and he joined the board, and then Upfront did, you know, their pro rata as part of it as well.
You know, you didn't raise money for Startup Grind. You did obviously for Bevy. Did you, and why? I mean, did you ever think about just using Startup Grind cash flow to build this? Like, what was the motivation behind going down the fundraising path?
Yeah. In the spring of 2017, we had about $350,000 in ARR. It was self-funded through Startup Grind. I sort of compare it to, it was like a golden anchor on dragging the bottom of the seafloor for the Startup Grind ship. It was going to golden sink the ship. And, it was clear that there was something there. But it was going to take it down because we were paying for engineers and we were servicing an enterprise product, and you got enterprise security, enterprise data, enterprise service, and all of this stuff. It's really expensive. And so we were not going to survive with paying all these engineers and this huge upfront cost of just supporting a product like this. And so that's when I almost in a panic, 1 week, realizing that I was going to run out of money, I emailed a bunch of past Startup Grind speakers and friends in the tech community. And thankfully, you know, it sort of was like it built relationships for 10 years to then, in some ways, cash in on those in this one moment when I really, really needed it. And I think I never asked people for money before. So when I came and asked for money with people that, you know, that trusted me or that had seen some of my work, there was a good relationship there, and we were able to quickly raise money. We split the two companies, took the engineers out of Startup Grind, moved them into Bevy, And that gave us enough working capital to, you know, to get through the next year and then to raise another $4.5 million.
Yeah. Really cool. You've already answered my question, how you put that together. I mean, I figured you had the network to tap and obviously you did. Talk about Series A. So, you know, Upfront's a pretty well respected VC. How did you put that round together? Did you run a process? Did you talk to a lot of investors? Do you have a lot of investors coming after you?
You know, I wouldn't say we had a lot of investors coming at us. No, I had a few investors I had talked to the summer before with the angel round, and we weren't really looking to raise, you know, from like a VC firm. We just honestly, like, we were still so early. We're pretty frugal. Like, we weren't trying to sort of get too diluted too early. And so, you know, there's a few different relationships I had made then. And we had said, hey, look, around, you know, won't work for you investing us now, but, you know, maybe later. And Kobe Fuller, the partner at Upfront that I worked with, I got introduced to him via Mark Suster, who had spoken at Startup Grind. I originally emailed Mark, and Mark said, oh, Kobe's interested in this space. You should talk to him. And, you know, we hit it off. I think what I really appreciate about him over just about anybody else I've ever met is he really understood the space. He was really thoughtful about the space. He'd spent time in it. He cared about it. He had, you know, thoughtful ideas around it and where it needed to go. And then, you know, when he was like, hey, I would like to invest in you, that meant something because of his conviction in what he knew about the space. And so, we did have more than one offer for the Series A. We ultimately went with Upfront and Kobe for those reasons. And so, you know, also, like, I think I looked at different, you know, partners and wanted somebody sort of earlier in their career, somebody who was trying to build a name for themselves, which is what we're trying to do. Somebody that I thought would maybe work a little harder than somebody that was older in their career and maybe had less to prove. You know, not that age is any sort of issue, or I'd happily take an investor that was, you know, at the end of their career, if they were still very, very hungry
on their deathbed,
successful. Yeah, I guess. But I think, like, that was something deliberate that we did, is like try to find somebody that is just going to go out and really work hard. And I think that's what we got with Kobe.
That's interesting. Yeah. I don't hear that, you know, doing these interviews, you hear a lot of things about personal fit and stuff, but I like that as one of the little check boxes, you know, who's going to work hardest and possibly have something to prove, you know. I think that's good. Cool, man. Good stuff. Any other notable tales from that round?
When I pitched, I don't know that I've ever shared this, but why not? When I pitched, I walked out of the room and I thought I had blown it. I thought for sure that I was not going to get an offer. And particularly there were some questions at the very end around market size. And I just completely blew that kind of line of questioning, you know, total addressable market and all that stuff. Like, I just didn't have good answers for it. And I took the plane back to Palo Alto or San Jose, and I was just like, oh, you know, you just like, oh man, that stinks, you know? And I landed and Kobe called me in walking through the airport, and he was like, hey, we want to get an offer for you, a term sheet for you. And so, you know, and then I've had other pitches where I thought I crushed it. And it's like, sorry, you're out. Like, you just don't know. So you just need, you know, you kind of try to act like every step of it, like keep your head high and try to be confident and try to be humble and grateful. And you just don't know. And, thankfully that ended up working out, but I thought for sure that I had, based off of how I had pitched, that I had blown it.
I totally find that to be true too. Like, there is, whether it's because they have a good poker face or it's just sort of almost random, like there's no pattern between how I feel a pitch went and the result. I totally agree with that. So that's interesting.
We pitched somebody recently. I mean, recently, like, you know, with this Series B, and it was the day we were pitching this group, like the day after it had my Star Grind conference. And, I thought we did great. I mean, we had all these amazing growth metrics and all these logos and stuff. And the feedback that I got was that we that we were really low energy. And that, you know, it's kind of a funny thing to like give feedback on, like, and I'm not like a, I'm not like, I'm pretty like even keel. So like, yeah, I'm not like, like crazy like this all the time. Cause I just like, that's just, I try to just kind of be like this.
Uh-huh.
Like, it's sort of funny to get criticized for something like that, but it's like, hey, like y'all seem really like low energy. And if you're not excited about the idea or not, it's like, well, you know, we just hosted a 10,000 person event yesterday and we're running around pitching everybody. Like, so, anyways, like, you know, you just don't know, you know, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work.
Just okay. Let's talk about this Series B that just happened. So did you initiate fundraising during the pandemic, or were you already fundraising kind of before the world went crazy?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's not one day where the world went crazy, so it's hard to sort of define it exactly, but definitely like this spring, we, you know, had started to look at it. We had a great Q4 and we started to sort of take that momentum and look to really, you know, scale out what we were doing this year. And, you know, it was in the midst of everything, you know, the market crashing and, you know, events sort of turning upside down. We started to see, I think I spent a few weeks really feeling sorry for myself and, you know, and worried about the future and cleaned my garage three times. And, and then all of a sudden our customers started using our product in this really new and different way, which was for virtual. And actually the results were better than in person. I don't know, like if in 5 years that's going to be the case or who can predict the future, but I think like there's this unique time, right, where we're all stuck in front of our computers and everyone's accessible and everyone's glued behind Zoom or whatever. And so, so we just saw our customers really taking advantage of that. And that, at the same time, the sort of virtual event space has started to really heat up. And we have a pretty unique perspective of being community driven in that space. I think we're the only product, like you can host a virtual event, that's fine, but like building a community around those event programs and other things, I think is a really powerful and critical component of doing events. And that's really like what we've been talking about. We acquired a company called CMX last year, which helps community professionals build their careers. So like we're, you know, I've been building community for 10 years, like we're really invested in community. And it's been exciting to see so many more people talking about community during the pandemic. But, you know, it's sort of this up and down thing for us where it was like, hey, we have this great Q4, everything's great. And it's like, oh my gosh, like our product's useless. It's in-person events. It's literally like illegal to use Bevy. And then it was like, oh my gosh, like our product is being used at these unheard of levels that we've never seen before. And with the results, you know, are exponentially better than they were with in person, like, and the space is like so hot, like, you know, and so it's like all these things kind of happening at once. And that sort of led to us closing around with XL and some of the others I mentioned before. And, you know, hopefully using that to, you know, continue to fight in the market and to be successful.
To clarify something, was Bevy designed to manage community for in-person events, and did you kind of pivot or have to rebuild or add to the product to handle virtual events? Maybe clarify that a little bit.
Yeah. So we've always done virtual events for the last, I mean, we've done them. I've hosted virtual events for 7 years with Startup Grind. Bevy has, you know, been a part of those events for 3 years. The usage of the product went from being mostly in person to basically all virtual. You know, we're seeing already actually some in-person events coming back in places like China. They're starting to actually get together in person again, which is sort of jarring for the system. But, you know, our use case is like smaller, you sort of meet up like 50 or less, 30 or less people. That's our primary use case. Mm. We're not really like in-person conference software. There's other tools that do a good job at that. But if you want to do a lot of locally based events, you know, in hundreds of cities at once, like, or 10 cities at once, you know, we're really good at solving that problem. So we have enhanced the product to support virtual more. We spent most of the year just working on that. What we just announced this last week is end-to-end a virtual event community solution where you can come in and create the event, have people sign up, do your registration. All of the virtual experience happens inside the platform. Again, on your website, it's branded to your logo. It's, you know, it's in your experience and all of that. And then, you know, all the post event and everything, it's all self-contained. And what we've learned is that data around that is really cool and useful to building deeper relationships with your customers. And if I go do that on Zoom, or if I go do that on Meet or something else, like those platforms are great. And we're literally doing this on Zoom. But if I'm doing like these huge events, that data is going to slowly bleed out. And like, it's connecting all these different pieces from virtual, when in-person comes back in person, run by our company, run by our customers, connecting all these pieces together. That sort of that data profile, that community data profile that you have on a customer is, can be really, really powerful. So the end-to-end solution managing the entire process now for virtual is make sure that you don't really lose any of that, and you can help them as much as possible.
Talk about raising during a pandemic. Like, where did you do most, first of all, how did you put together kind of target list? Where did you again tap your network? And then did you do most of it virtually, like Zoom pitches? And maybe if you can comment on, you know, what investors are doing today, right? There's all this chatter on Twitter and everywhere else about, are VCs open for business? Are they watching and waiting? You know, any kind of inside peek that you can comment on there?
I mean, if you're going to raise money, this is obvious, but I think as entrepreneurs, sometimes we don't look at this or think we care to ignore this part of it, but like where is the scarcity and demand for what you have? And you have to create that. Some of it is generated by marketing, and some of it is generated by your results and your revenue or your customer base or whatever. Could be your design, could be your team. But you have to create demand with investors. And if you don't have demand, like, you're not going to get a good deal. And if you're not going to get a good deal, I don't think you should raise money. I mean, sometimes you have to raise money. But I've always, as a bootstrapper, like, been in the camp of, if you have to raise money, you should go sell. Like, sell to your customers, like, get money through your product. Like, don't be reliant on, you know, doing a bad deal with a VC to serve, you know, to get out of a really tight spot. Sell your way out. Mm-hmm. But I think with raising the B round, you know, first and foremost, like, we had an amazing year last year. We 3x'd revenue. That's like this SaaS number that, you know, I mean, it was down to the wire, but like, that's, you always want to aim for the best. That's what we aim for. Like, this thing that people talk about, you know, triple, double, 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 or whatever it is. So yeah. Like, mm-hmm. We wanted to triple our revenue last year. Thankfully we did. That made, you know, a lot of conversations easy to start. I've also heard a lot of people say, like, if your investors in your previous rounds aren't making introductions for you and helping you raise your next round, like, they're not doing their job. And so I think, you know, Kobe introduced us to 5 or 6 investors with living in Palo Alto for 15 years. I've known a lot of different investors. So there was kind of a target list that I had of people that I was excited to work with. And thankfully for us, you know, the world's kind of collided at the right time where Ryan Sweeney from Excel, I put him as a, you know, lottery pick for anybody that could get him to invest, or Excel, of course, is one of the best, if not the best venture capital firm in the Valley. So, you know, I'm fortunate with that. But I think, you know, spending, as you said, like, spending time, you know, sometimes you can't choose. Like, you get an offer, like, you need to take that offer, negotiate the best deal you can. There's plenty of honor in doing that. But I think what I try to say is, like, look, if I could pick who I could work with, both from a human being standpoint, also from a tracker standpoint, who would those people be? And then aim for those, and then expect maybe I can't hit that target, and have a backup and a backup to the backup. But in this case, we were fortunate to sort of, you know, hit the mark with who we had hoped to work with. And I'm super grateful for that. I know that has not happened to me basically, you know, almost any other time in my career. So, yeah. You know, there have been times I wanted to raise money, thought I should raise money for something, and, you know, it didn't work out. It's happened lots and lots of times. So,
yeah, interesting. Did you initiate pitches with Ryan before the lockdown? Or, I mean, I don't assume you did it all virtually, did you?
No, we did. I mean, I've known him for a long time. Okay. So, and we, you know, actually the first time I ever pitched Ryan Smith, who joined the board, was actually in Excel's office about 3 years ago. So, you know, I've known them through Startup Grind for a number of years, a number of their different partners. One of their partners' kids goes to school with my kids. You know, so they're just really good people. And we've interacted in different levels and places. And so there was sort of a natural conversation there that happened.
Got it. Cool, man. I won't keep you too much longer. You know, you've probably heard 1,000 hours of content from your speakers and your events on fundraising. Are there any like couple key lessons that have just really like stuck with you or that really just pop out in your head? I know that's a big question.
I mean, I kind of talked about this a little bit before, but you have to create leverage for yourself. It's mm-hmm. It's the same with any deal you get, but especially with VCs, like how are you going to create demand? How are you going to create leverage? How are you going to create scarcity? That's the only way to get somebody to make a decision on investing. And those things could be getting multiple offers. Those things could be some significant revenue, you know, jumps. Those things could be a black swan event like what happened with us, which is totally unpredictable, but like we had to react to it, and I think we've reacted appropriately to it. But you have to create urgency, and so I think like as you're going into this process of raising funding or trying to raise funding, like you can't sound, it's funny because you can't sound desperate either. Like you have to create urgency, but not sound desperate. You have to like show you have to like be the exact opposite. You have to like show complete confidence. Like I don't need this,
but
I will let you be part of it, but only for a very short window because there's these other things happening that are out of my control that are like, you know, that are big. And so, you know, trying to balance all those things while still maintaining some humility. And like, it's like, how do you create urgency, you know, show some bravado and still maintain some humility? It's like, it's a very difficult balance. And I've, from all the deals I've lost over the years for not having those things, like it's the same thing with VCs. They want to win. They're very competitive. They don't, and in some ways they don't want to lose. Almost more than they want to win.
What do you mean?
Just they don't, you know, they're in a very, very competitive industry. They're in an industry that talks to each other a lot. They're constantly talking, right? Like the VC like sphere of like chatter is mind numbing. Like they don't want to be the person that missed out. In some ways more than the person that won. So if you can, if you can, you know, nobody wants to be to have the story about missing, well, maybe it's not Airbnb anymore, but YouTube, you know, Mike Maples Jr. talks about how when he couldn't get in the YouTube round, it was like watching a hot air balloon just take off to the sky. And, you know, like nobody wants that story. You've got to somehow with humility, with urgency, convince them that you are the YouTube that's going to be floating off into the sky. Mm-hmm. And if they don't make the decision in the immediate short-term future, this will ruin their chance of being on the Midas list. And if you can accurately, you know, if you can paint a good picture for that, then you might convince them to actually sign the term sheet.
I love it. That's good. Be the hot air balloon, the YouTube hot air balloon floating off into the sky. That's our goal. Good stuff, my man. Great. And if people want to learn more, it's bevy.com. That's bevy.com, correct?
Exactly.
Is there a minimum number of, like, how small is too small? You mentioned like 50, you know, people are interested in becoming customers. You mentioned like kind of use case of 50 or so people per event or what?
I mean, I think it's if you're interested in building a virtual event program and you're trying to figure out how, you know, if you're just going to do one event a month or something, there's some really easy, cheap tools to use. If you're saying like, hey, this is going to be a critical part of our growth strategy, and we care about the brand, we care about the experience, we care about the data, then, you know, Bevy's the right tool for you to use.
Perfect.
But, you know, if you're a one or two person startup, I mean, my recommendation would be, you know, go use an Eventbrite or go use Meetup. And we partner with Meetup. So you could use meetup.com. And then, once that gets working, you do a few events there, then, you know, come back and work with us and, you know, and partner, you know, with Meetup, and we can help you kind of scale that out. You know, I've seen some companies get $5 to $10 million in new ARR, like startups, not huge, like not Google, Salesforce kinds of people, but like small startups get $5 to $10 million in new ARR every year from these programs. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's not a small startup. I shouldn't say that, but like those are startups that started out like me or probably people listening to this podcast. Like you can, like events are, again, 40% of customer acquisition pipeline for most SaaS companies comes from events. So what's your strategy? Could you increase your pipeline by 40% by having a smart event strategy? Yes, you could. Would that be valuable to you? Yes, it probably would. So what's a thoughtful, most cost-effective way to do that? And you know, start small and then build from there.
I love it. I'm going to check it out myself. Thank you, sir. I've kept you long enough.
Thanks, Nathan.
Have a great rest of your week. Stay safe.
Thanks so much.